Well, good afternoon, everyone. Pleasure to be with you today. The little saints have just come marching in. That's nice. I'd like to thank Mr. Rochelle for that lovely special music. Like son, like father, like son, you might say. I'd like to begin by reading a letter from a grandfather to be. He was born in 1960, this grandfather to be. I'll give you that much background, and then just ask you to listen for a few minutes as I read this letter, which actually appeared in the Wall Street Journal, but it is appropriate to my topic, if you will bear with me. Dear grandchildren, at least a decade before any of you were born, I'm writing to tell you things about home and family that took me decades to understand. These days, Americans aren't so interested in buying homes. The proportion of people who own one is around its lowest level in three decades. Many young workers, your parents' generation, would rather rent. Join them and you will gain freedom from leaky roofs, leaky faucets, and the ability to move wherever and whenever you please. But you will lose something too, something that goes beyond the question of your finances and building equity. And you should understand what that is. This past week, just before Thanksgiving, my brother and I helped our 87-year-old mother get ready to move out of the house she has lived in for half a century, 50 years. 50 years. In 1961, when I was 2 years old, my parents were roving northern New York State looking for a country house where they could escape the pressures of the weekly newspaper they ran near Hartford, Connecticut. Somehow they ended up in Belcher, New York, a hamlet of fewer than 100 people and more than 300 cows. Good statistic. The nearest stoplight was, and still is, 12 miles away. Sounds like Houston. Mom and Dad took one look at Hall's Pond, a 20-acre sapphire blue lake set down amid white birches at the top of a hill overlooking the green mountains of Vermont, and told each other they had found Eden. They paid $13,000 for 96 acres, including the lake, two cabins, an outhouse, and the farmhouse at the foot of the hill, plus the two-acre pond across the dirt road from the house. With low ceilings, exposed beams, creaking floors, and steps so small that you had to walk pigeon-toed to climb upstairs. I remember that. That was my grandmother's house. Pigeon-toed was the only way to go up, and going down was a danger to your life. The three-bedroom house smelled like dust and had changed very little since it was built probably in the 1840s. The water came from a shallow stone-lined well that went dry almost every August, forcing us to haul buckets up from the pond. I guess if you ran from the pond to the house, you could call it running water. Dad, your great-grandfather, had been a farmer, a boxer, a semi-pro baseball player, commander of a minesweeper in World War II, and a political science professor. He died in 1981 after a long struggle against lung cancer. Dad insisted on dying at home with his boots on. Mom still kept his ashes and her mother's in a drawer in the living room. Ever since Dad died, she has lived alone in the middle of nowhere, rejecting all offers of help from us and her neighbors, profoundly hard of hearing, her eyesight fading. She used a long-handled grabber to pull glass jars full of pasta out of her cupboards, which are so fully and neatly stacked she could survive a nuclear war. Until a few years ago, she mowed the lawn herself. Only last winter did Mom finally concede it might be time to leave. I have no emotional attachment to the house, she said. I never liked it physically. But everything important that ever happened in our life as a family is here, and I can't just leave all that behind. Now, the letter goes on to describe how they helped their mother scatter the ashes of her husband and her mother in the pond. They walk back to the cabin arm in arm. The property is sold, and mother moves on. Quite a story. You know, Bob Dylan was right. You remember Bob Dylan? The gravelly-voiced folk singer of the 1960s, never could stand his voice. Remember his song, "The Times, They Are A-Changin'"? Some of you are old enough to remember that, and some of you are old enough to remember that but are afraid to admit that you're old enough to remember that. Bob Dylan thought the times were changing. Well, we ain't seen nothing yet, and my, how times are changing right before our eyes. So rapidly, so quickly, it is hard to fathom. I want you to remember the letter this potential grandfather wrote to his future grandchildren as we discuss a few elements of our culture and society today, as we are in the midst of change that I dare say is unprecedented in the history of the human race as far as its speed and comprehensive nature. Do you remember the books Famine 1975 and The Population Bomb? How many remember that? I remember that. What happened in 1975? Did whole nations die of starvation? No, it never really transpired, but it was frightening reading, wasn't it? For those of you that read it, it made sense at the time. We're going to run out of food. The population of nations around the world is multiplying so quickly that we're going to run out of food. We're going to have to make the tough choices. Some nations will live, some nations will die. The population bomb will explode. It really never happened, did it? Listen to this article excerpted from the Wall Street Journal of November 23rd, 2015. The world's new population time bomb. You know, some of this has happened unbeknownst to us because as you age, you kind of think, well, all things are as they were, but all things aren't as they were. Things are changing very rapidly. Maybe not in your house, but in our world, they are changing rapidly and dramatically. Next year, to quote the article, the world's advanced economies will reach a critical milestone. For the first time since 1950, their combined working age populations will decline, according to UN projections. And by 2050, they will shrink by 5%. In other words, we're running out of workers. The ranks of workers will also fall in China and in Russia. At the same time, the share of these countries' population over 65 will do what? Boom, skyrocket. Previous generations fretted about the world having too many people. Today's problem may very well be too few people. This reflects two long-established trends, lengthening lifespans and declining fertility. Simply put, companies are running out of workers, customers, or both. In either case, economic growth suffers. As populations age, what people buy also changes, shifting more demand towards services such as healthcare and away from durable goods such as cars and houses and clothing. You know, look at some of the things we're wearing. We bought those 20 years ago. We just think they're still in style. When's the last time you bought new clothes? We don't. I couldn't get them in the closet if I bought new clothes. What would you do? So, Bob Dylan was right. The times, they're a-changing, but very quickly. I want to take a look at millennials. I know you've heard a lot about generations, but please keep in mind the grandfather's letter as we describe the millennials and their characteristics as a generation. Now, this information is taken from Experian.com. They are a marketing organization. They are trying to tell marketers what they will have to do to market to millennials, to sell millennials' products. So let's listen in as they give advice to marketers. Millennials were born in 1980, immediately following Generation X. They are celebrating their 35th birthday this year. They came of age during what is now being called, get this, the Great Recession. The Great Recession, as though there were some similarity to the Great Recession and the Great Depression. I doubt it. But nonetheless, that's how they grew up. They are less religious than any other generation. They hold to progressive values and own smartphones exceeding every other generation and account for 1 out of every 2 minutes Americans spend using these devices. While the rest of us are amazed at what smartphones and the internet can do, millennials view these marvels as entirely normal. And as a result, they have high expectations about how things should work and how things should get done. They have instant expectations. They grew up with this technology, and there's nothing really amazing about it to them. It's standard operating procedure. Millennials are also 2.5 times more likely. Listen carefully to these statistics. It's quite shocking. Millennials are 2.5 times more likely than the silent generation, my parents, 1.8 times more likely than boomers, me, and 1.7 times more likely than Generation X, my children, to identify as gay, lesbian, transgender, or bisexual. So that trend is increasing, identifying yourself in a variety of sexual ways. How you came out of the womb is of little relevance. Shocking. They embrace diversity. Well, that's how you survive. Diversity and tolerance, the two greatest attributes that a human being could possess, it seems. They embrace diversity and open-mindedness. 69% support the legalization of marijuana. 62% have never been married, and of those who have married, only 36% have children at home. They're not getting married. They're not having children. Dear grandchildren, remember the letter? Remember that old creaky house that Mother never liked, the pigeon-toed stairs, 50 years in the same house? How do you go home if you don't have a home? Think about it. Only 58% of their places of residence, as opposed to 73% of those 35 and over, are owned by millennials. Surprisingly, approximately 18% of millennials say that a woman's place is in the home. That is shocking. Which puts them on a par with the silent generation, that's my parents, when it comes to this issue. Just 11% of boomers and Generation Xers agree that a woman's place is in the home. 53% of millennials say that they want to get to the very top of their chosen career, a rate much higher than Gen Xers, 38%, and boomers, 25%. Of course, boomers, we know our days are numbered. We're not going to get to the top. No wonder our percentage is low. But millennials want to get to the top. Overall, millennials are 19% more likely than average to say that money is the best measure of success. And one-third of all millennials say that they only go to their current job for the money. That's all. Just trying to get the money. Where's the fulfillment? Where's the purpose? Who are you working for? Yourself and the money. Let's take a look at marriage in the 21st century. I took this from Timothy Keller's book, The Meaning of Marriage. Some of you may have read some of Mr. Keller's books. They're quite good, actually. He writes, "The notion that the best marriages are those that bring satisfaction to the individual may seem counterintuitive." That doesn't make sense. After all, isn't marriage supposed to be about putting the relationship first? Well, is it? He writes, "Not anymore. Not anymore. For centuries, marriage was viewed as an economic and social institution, and the emotional and intellectual needs of the spouses were secondary to the survival of the marriage itself." Today, that's kind of a novel approach. In modern relationships, people are looking for a partnership, and they want partners who make their lives more interesting, who help each of them attain their valued goals. In other words, what can you do for me? How can you enhance my life? Therein lies part of the problem, I think, with modern marriages. Did Christ marry the church because she was beautiful, righteous, and could make his life better? Was he? What was it about the church that was so attractive? What was it about ancient Israel that was so attractive that caused God to covenant with them? Where did he find Israel? Kind of all bloody and bruised in the ditch. He had to pick her up and wash her off and cleanse her and purify her, just as he has to cleanse and purify the church. What was in it for Christ as he married the church? What is the underlying motive of so much of what is going on in our world today? Marriage used to be a public institution for the common good. Now it is a private arrangement for the satisfaction of the individuals. Marriage used to be about us. Now it seems marriage is about me. And is that why so many of them fail? Indeed, our world is in the midst of a massive transformation. How much longer will marriage, family, home, and hearth remain as a viable and worthy goal and aspiration for young people? How long? With each succeeding generation, the grandfather-to-be knows he's writing the letter, "Dear grandchildren, here's what it means to have a home. Here's what you can have." But how many generations will embrace those values? Traditional values and institutions are under siege, fading fast under the relentless pressure of a society and culture that have cast off the old way in favor of the new. It's not something that will happen. It is already well underway, isn't it? Today's modern female has jettisoned the old stereotypes and has fully vested herself in any and all pursuits that were once the domain of men, from the locker room to the courtroom, from the boardroom to the battlefield. And recently, I'm sure you heard that women are now eligible to serve in any and every capacity in the armed services of the United States of America that they can qualify to serve in. There is no gender-specific restriction. Despite the research that says that may not be a good idea, it now is part of our national perspective. Women are competing with men at every level, and any reference to their former state of femininity, submission, motherhood, a meek and quiet spirit, helpers of joy, support to their husband, all of that is met with cries of bigotry, stereotyping, and discrimination. Is it any wonder that marriage in our world, not just our nation, but marriage in our world may soon become universally gender neutral, inviting any combination of partners to apply and receive equal protection under the law? Where is family, home, and hearth headed? These factors, combined with the all-encompassing pursuit of self-fulfillment, have all contributed to this tragic state of affairs. So much so that millennials have been called the selfie generation. Now, we all know what selfies are. You hold the camera out. In fact, I bought a selfie stick for the feast in Ireland. I felt a little goofy. I couldn't figure it out at first, but I finally got it going. I took a few. But it's back in my closet. I don't know. I may market it on Craigslist to some young one. But you see, the implication is not just the selfie generation, but the self-oriented, selfish generation. It's coming. It's here. And you know, millennials are not the only group affected by all the phenomena that I've tried to relate in a brief rapid-fire sequence. For we're all affected by the focus on the self that our society and culture has cultivated, that the media have cultivated. For has there ever been a time in human history when the self could be so quickly and completely satisfied and satiated by simply what? Touching a screen. And I hate to even say the next one, clicking a mouse. How backward is that? Clicking a mouse. Who clicks a mouse anymore? Very few people. We want the touch screen. We want instant response. What is to become of qualities, character traits, such as delayed gratification? Delayed gratification. I can't have it now, but I'm going to work hard and save up so I can have it later. Or I can't have it now because I have other people depending on me and relying on me to provide the basic necessities of life for them, so I can't have it now, and I'm fine with that. What is going on with delayed gratification? Can it even be defined by millennials? What is delay? Well, there is no delay. It's instant. What about sacrifice, selflessness, living for someone or something greater than the self? All qualities that are naturally engendered and nurtured in the now vanishing building block of nations, societies, and cultures for generations, for millennia, marriage and the family. That foundation is crumbling dramatically right before our eyes. So what about it? Is there life beyond the self? How are we to measure success in this life and prepare ourselves for our future in the kingdom of God? For that is our future, really, isn't it? Millennials work for money. Millennials want to get to the top of their game. And they don't want to be fettered and restricted by all these family, home, and hearth issues. And children, the burden of children. When it's all over but the crying, what really constitutes a life well lived? Let's take some time to review God's opinion and perspective on this subject. Is there life beyond the self? Of course there is. But how many will realize it in our world as we see much of what we would call traditional family values evaporating? Let's begin in a very familiar verse, John 3, verse 16. John 3, 16. You all know it. We don't have to even turn there, but let's do it. Or you may use your device. You know how the Bible uses the word devices. We are not ignorant of his devices. One wonders. One wonders. They have a good use. They have a bad use. John 3:16. For God so loved the world that he gave. God so loved the world that he gave. So the way God expressed his love was to give something. His love for himself was simply a non-factor. Now God is going to benefit from having children, isn't he? He's going to have a family. He is reproducing himself. He's going to have a family. There will be benefits. But before those benefits come, there will be sacrifice. Ouch. And to give your only begotten son hurts. Something like delayed gratification, maybe. God was setting the pace. He was setting the example. Here's how you love, you give. He gave his only begotten son, and through that only begotten son came the gift of eternal life, potentially to all of mankind. In Romans 5 and verse 8, Romans 5 verse 8, God demonstrates his own love toward us. And I might add, Christ exhibited that same love. While we were yet sinners, Christ died for us. You know, scarcely, as it says in verse 7, for a righteous man will one die. Who are you willing to die for? What are you willing to give up for someone else? It's quite remarkable, isn't it? God demonstrates his love by giving his only begotten son. Christ gave his life. How glorious was it to leave the right hand of the Father and become flesh and dwell among us and suffer and die? How exciting was that? How fulfilling was that? Who is Christ, quote, looking out for, unquote? Something to think about. Quite a statement. The Lamb of God who took away the sin of the world. And he didn't wait until we were good enough to deserve it. He gave his life, unqualified, gave it, sacrificed it. So it looks like love involves giving and self-sacrifice, delayed gratification. Matthew 22. Verse 34, but when the Pharisees heard that he had silenced the Sadducees, they gathered together. So Christ was effective in silencing both the Pharisees and the Sadducees. A lawyer came to him with another question. Christ could always give the right answer. Don't you wish you could always give the right answer? I wish I even knew the right answer, much less able to give it under these conditions. But Christ obviously was Christ. And this lawyer was quite astute. Even Christ commended him for the wisdom of his statements. Notice, the question was in verse 36, teacher, what is the great commandment in the law? What is the superior, overarching, greatest commandment? Which is it? Well, Christ said to him, you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your mind. That is the first and great commandment. So what is left after that? All your heart, all your soul, and all your mind. Is all your money left after that? I don't think so. It is everything you and I have. That's how you love God, with everything you have got. And the second is like it. Or this, the King James says, like unto it. It's very similar. In principle, it's the same concept. You shall what? Love your neighbor. Now here comes the self. Here comes the self. In recognition of our proclivity and propensity for self-love. And of course, that's human nature. We inherited that from Satan. He loves himself too. He wants to overthrow God. He wants to take charge of the universe. That's his motive. It's all for self, all for him. He's ruthless and relentless. In recognition of our proclivity and propensity for self-love, God tells us that we are to love our neighbor, how? As we love our wife, as we love our new car, as we love ourselves. What does that tell you about the level and degree of our self-love? It must be pretty great. It's something that we all have to contend with. Satan has mined and exploited this aspect of human nature from the very beginning with devastating effectiveness. Because even Eve looked at the tree and said, you know, that looks like a tree that would make me smarter. Have you ever looked at a tree with fruit on it and said, yeah, I think if I ate that, I'd be smart? Not me. I could use the help, for sure, intellectually, but I've never seen a tree that would make me wise. The whole thing was, yeah, I can decide for myself. I don't need God. So she took of the fruit. She gave it to her husband. The rest is history. The focus was not on God with all her heart and mind and spirit. Satan turned her attention. And the attention of the human race has been turned ever since, away from God and toward the self. And it seems so logical, so natural. And yet, when you look at it in its bare component, it's a selfish orientation and approach. So on these two commandments, verse 40, hang all the law and all the prophets. In a sense, in a nutshell, everything the law and the prophets talks about hangs on these two commandments, love toward God and love toward your neighbor. And the only time the self comes in is when you are to look at the capacity for love that you have toward your neighbor as being the same level as you have for yourself. It's kind of embarrassing, isn't it? That husbands are told to love their wives as they love themselves. It's kind of humiliating in a sense that that's the measure. I wish he would have said, well, could you love your wife as much as I love you? Well, says God, no, I want you to love your wife as much as you love yourself. And I want you to give yourself as a living sacrifice for your wife, even as Christ gave himself. That is real love. And as Mr. Armstrong defined it, love is giving. These two commandments, love God and love your neighbor, leave little room for embracing the self. And yet it seems that we are running headlong away from those principles in our culture and society, and we are embracing the self and selfish pursuits that take our eyes off the prize of marriage and family, its purpose and meaning in the plan of God. And we have to be careful that we don't get caught up in that same maelstrom. Now continuing, if we look at God's perspective right from the start, he took the first man and the first woman. He said it's not good for a man to be alone. And sometimes when you wives leave us a home alone as husbands, when you come back, that's exactly what you say. It is not good for a man to be alone. Look at this mess. How did he survive? What happened in the living room? It smells like smoke in here, etc. God created man's perfect complement. Male and female created he them. Mankind, in order to reflect the power and might and majesty and comprehensive nature of the great God of the universe, God had to create two separate genders. And boy, are they different. And then he says, those two shall become one, even as Christ and the Father are one. So then you have the consummate reflection of God Almighty within the context of marriage as two become one, as the two complement each other and fulfill their God-given roles and responsibilities. And for the most part, Satan is now successful in undermining marriage to the point where gender neutral. What difference does it make? We all have a right to do whatever we want to do. Quite a commentary on our culture and society. They were to become fruitful and multiply and replenish the earth. And remember, fewer children are being born and more seniors are living longer. And is it an advantage to have children? If I don't want to own a house, I don't want to own a car, I don't want to be tied down, I don't want to be restricted in any way, I want to be able to move from job to job, from state to state, from country to country without anything holding me back. I want to reach my full potential. Now, could you help me? Would you want to marry me and help me reach my full potential? Well, no, I really don't, because I want to reach my full potential, and I want to go to the top of my career, and I want... So you can see how difficult that would be and how difficult it is. Nothing wrong with having a career, nothing wrong at all. I'm trying to comment on the nature of our culture and society that is rapidly running away from home and hearth and family. The foundational building blocks that God created from the beginning. You know, God himself set the pattern and the pace for life. Creation was not for him or his son. In other words, to their advantage, you might say. What part of creation did God need to sustain himself? Was he running out of air, water, food? I don't think so. I think he gave. That was his design from the beginning. To use a familiar phrase, as I mentioned earlier, what is in all of this for God? Why did he do all that he has done? Clearly, he did it out of love, out of outgoing concern. Not incoming advantage. He did it for the purpose of establishing his family and by commanding the first man and the first woman to be fruitful and multiply and replenish the earth. He was building his family and at the same time giving the husband and the wife, who ultimately would be identified as a type of Christ and the church, a chance to build their family and to engage in the same kind of self-sacrificing, outgoing love and concern for another person that is all a part of God and God's love for us. And you see why Satan wants to destroy that and to create a culture and a society that disdains that and embraces the self. God is in the process of reproducing himself. And in the course of his creative activity, he established what we might call his law of love, didn't he? The Ten Commandments, which show us what? How to love God and how to love our neighbor. We already summarized those. And there's a lot hanging on those two commandments, isn't there? All the law and all the prophets hanging right there. And what did Christ tell the lawyer when the lawyer rightly answered? He said, "You are not far from the kingdom of God. You almost get it." That's the whole duty of man. God created laws that show us how to love God and to love our neighbor. In addition to the laws of physics and chemistry, the law of gravity, for instance, God established not only laws that define and promote love or outgoing concern, but there are living principles that provide benefits for exercising that law of love. Notice in Luke chapter 6. Verse 38. We read this at holy offerings a lot of times. "Give, and it will be given to you." You know, when I was a child, that would be a very difficult concept. I have my toys, I have what is mine, and my sister wants it. And if my mother said, "Give, and it will be given unto you," I would say, "You are out of your mind. I'm not going to give anything that is mine to my sister, I'm going to hang on to what is mine, and frankly, I'm going to try to get some stuff that's hers and make it mine too, because that's how you get more, right? That's the way human nature, at least, appears to look at it. If you have, and you strive to get more, well then, you'll get more. And if you have, and you give it to other people, well that's stupid. You shouldn't do that. How are you going to get ahead? You know, one of our sons was really a giver. There was one time we bought him some brand new clothes. They weren't that expensive, but, you know, they cost money. And a couple weeks later, I said, "Where are those new pants I bought you?" "Oh, well, I gave them to so-and-so," because he really liked them. And I caught myself, thankfully. I didn't say, "What are you doing? You don't give those things." I said, "Well, that was very thoughtful of you." but I swallowed hard. And it wasn't as though he came to me and said, Dad, I want another pair. I gave those away. He didn't care. Now, I don't say that in the sense that he was just, you know, fickle and not considerate of other people. He just kind of threw things around without thought or consideration. But it pleased him to give. It still pleases him to give. And how pleasant is that giving experience for most of us? The getting experience, especially this time of year. Ay, ay, ay. Everybody's buying things. Everybody's getting things. It is more blessed to get than to give. Is that right? No. But how does human nature think? Well, so the scripture says, give and it will be given to you. Well, now, Christ takes it a little further. Here's how it will be given to you. It will be given in good measure. And once we measure it out, it's going to be a very generous measure. Then we're going to pound it down. Then we're going to put some more in there. Then we're going to shake it up. Then we're going to put some more in there. Until it's running over. So the way to make your life run over is to give, not to get. Very important principle to learn, not always easy to exercise. For with the same measure that you use, it will be measured back to you. The same measuring scoop you use to give will be used when God gives back to you. Think about that. See, the giveaway is totally contrary, for the most part, to what the world is promoting and what the internet promotes. Everything is geared toward you. You ever notice when you're, let's say you're going shopping online for scissors, and you go to Home Depot, you go to Bed Bath & Beyond, and you're looking around, and you didn't see anything you liked. So the next day, you Google something, and suddenly, off on the right, there are scissors ads. Are you still interested in buying a scissors? Well, here, well, click, doop, boop, suddenly you're buying a scissors. And people, the internet knows everything, don't they? They know everything about you, what your preferences are, and information is everywhere. And we can satisfy whatever we want. We live in a very green tree that way, don't we? And it's easy to get comfortable with this. Well, don't get too comfortable. Because if we grasp this living concept of God's love and apply it in every aspect of our lives, what would the world be like? If the self was removed from its primary position to its necessary secondary position. In every incident, in every case. What if we all realized, in essence, that life is not really all about us? It is all about others, and that's by God's design. Remember, the two great commandments. You love God and you love your neighbor. There's no third commandment that says love yourself. God doesn't have to say that. That's already taken care of. It's already understood. So we have to work to fulfill those two commandments. What if we esteemed or valued everyone above ourselves? How hard is that? Not easy, is it? Now, some people are hard to esteem and value above yourself, are they? Well, I have my friends and I have my close relatives, I have people that I love and I enjoy being around, but then there are these other people and I don't really have too much time for them. I don't value them as much as I value these people, and I'm not sure I value them as much as I value myself. and we get into a pecking order and we compare ourselves, and suddenly we're thinking about the self quite a bit. What if we never did anything out of spite, conceit, or selfish ambition? All scriptural, of course. I don't need to turn there. You know the verses. What if we never allowed that kind of motivation to cause us to take action? What would our lives be like? What if we dedicated our lives to meeting the needs of others? Obviously, in balance as we seek to meet our own needs. Isn't that the idea? Isn't that why Christ died and set the example, Christ living in us? You know, one might call marriage the graduate school of love or outgoing concern and giving. For it is in marriage that two separate and very different people are to become one. Now that's a feat which Christ and the Father have already achieved. It's something that we as the brethren of Christ are to achieve, because Christ did pray in John 17 that they may be one even as we are one. And then we are supposed to, as one, become one with the Father and Son so that we are all one. It's an amazing thought, isn't it? How hard is it to become one with your mate? Now, when you're young and in love and when you're first married, it is glorious. It is easy. It's like falling off a log. And it's just, you know, on the street where you live. You know, the pavement always stayed beneath my feet before. All at once am I several stories high, knowing I'm on the street where you live. People stop and stare, they don't bother me, for there's nowhere else on earth I'd rather be. 10 years later, let me out of here. I'm not being fulfilled. I can't have my boat. I can't have my Corvette. I can't have anything. What happens? What happens? Becoming one. We have dozens of opportunities every day to achieve this kind of oneness, but it can't be achieved if the self is allowed to live and to breathe. The self has got to step aside. I wonder if that's part of the reason we're baptized. We bury that old man. But he likes to bring his head up out of the water and remind us of how important he is. You know, the formula is really quite simple. Every day of your life, all of us should present ourselves as a living sacrifice, holy and acceptable to God. That's our reasonable service. Sometimes I think we have to take a good look at this concept, because often you think, well, I'd give my life for my wife if she was on the railroad tracks, and I would run up there and I would pick her up and I would toss her to safety and the train would run over me. That's giving my life. Well, that's true. But which is easier? Giving your life in front of that train, or waking up every morning and loving your wife and giving yourself for her? How hard is that? And of course, you have stayed the same for 35 years, right? You are Carl consistent. Never. You're like the law of the Medes and the Persians. You never change. It's your wife. She is, well, she's premenopausal, she's menopausal, she's postmenopausal. She's got this, she's got that, she thinks this. You know, I'm the same, she's different. You're not the woman I married. Well, guess what? You're not the man she married. You're changing. We are constantly in the change mode. We are adapting. We are growing. Our preferences, our appearance, everything about us is in a state of flux. That's the way God created us. And the consistent thing in marriage is selfless love. It's very hard to achieve. It's not easy. And of course, it should be not only in marriage, but in our whole lives. We should be looking for that kind of opportunity. You know, we're to spend our life, our energy, our time, our talents, and our money making the lives of others happier and more fulfilling. That's really the godly way. And all of that in the course of our efforts to sustain our own life. It's not that you shouldn't care about yourself. Because my son gave a pair of pants away, did that break the bank? Did that send us to the poor farm? No. But he learned an important lesson. He taught me an important lesson. Give and it shall be given unto you. Every day we have a chance to exercise that. You know, in Matthew chapter 25, when the sheep and the goats stand before Jesus Christ, you all know this account. Both the sheep and the goats had the same question for Christ. When Christ said, you know, when I was hungry, you gave me meat. When I was thirsty, you gave me drink. When I needed clothing, you gave me something to wear. Both the sheep and the goats said, when did we see you in these conditions? Well, the goats asked the question because in the back of their minds, they were saying, well, if I knew it was you, I would have done something. But since it wasn't you, obviously I didn't do anything. Now, the sheep said, I didn't know. Where did we see you? I didn't know it was you. Christ said what? If you have done it to the least of these, my brethren, you have done it to me. What does that tell you? Reaching out to other people is the same as reaching out to Jesus Christ. That outgoing concern. And of course, we could talk about so many other biblical examples of that kind of outgoing concern. Our relationship with others, our relationship with our spouse, how important are these relationships? They are very important. They appear to be mission critical. Christ brings it up when the sheep and the goats are gathered together. You know, from infancy, the self is probably the dominant force in our lives. And it seems abundantly clear that God intended for us to change that emphasis. In the old days, young men and women, in the real old days, young men and women became husbands and wives. Then they became fathers and mothers. Then they became grandfathers and grandmothers, charged with the task of instilling within their children the give way. Through discipline, instruction, and above all, by example. Because when you're in a family, the give way is important. Supporting each other is important. Loving one another is important. Sacrificing for each other is important. Sadly, in many marriages, husbands and wives fail to rise to the challenge of becoming one. And that selfish nature rears its ugly head and begins to dictate the ground rules of their relationship. What if every wife recognized the value of submission to her husband and its relationship to her submission to Jesus Christ? Would her willing, loving, and feminine submission to her husband encourage her husband to love her as Christ loved the church and gave himself for it? Have you ever noticed that in many relationships, if you find yourself wanting something out of that relationship, the best way to get that something is to give that same something to your mate. And then you would be amazed at what comes back. That's the give way. God blessed husbands and wives with the gift of sexual relations to enhance, strengthen, and sustain the bond between them that makes them one. In marriage and in life, the self must constantly be set aside, sidelined, throttled, and at times silenced, if this oneness is to be promoted and the giveaway is to be achieved. The refiner's fire of marriage can be relentless at times. And just when you think that you've married the right person, it's 2 weeks, 2 months, 2 years, it's been heavenly bliss. You think you're making progress, and then comes the baby. With all their demands on your time and your relationship. We've all been there. The delivering doctor told my wife the night before our firstborn came into the world, get a good night's sleep, you won't get another one for 21 years. Or more. So, suddenly, utopia is shattered by the reality of a screaming, crying, colicky, poopy-diapered baby. And suddenly your wife does not look like a movie star when you come home. Of course, neither do you. There are other demands on your time. Babies, just like other people, can bring out the self in us. Why won't he get up and help me? Why doesn't she have more time for me? Why won't that kid stop crying so I can sleep? And so on. Then with multiple children, then you have the terrible twos. You have teenagers. You have college expenses. You have stress levels on the rise. The self can rear its ugly head, and the give way turns into the get way, and suddenly you're dyeing your hair and buying a sports car and driving off into the sunset, looking for someone 30 years your junior that shares your passion. Good luck. And you've left it all behind. When will you live in a house for 50 years with your husband's or your mate's ashes and walk pigeon-toed up the stairs? Even though you hate the house, everything that happened to your family happened there, and you just can't leave it. Well, what happens on Facebook doesn't stay on Facebook, but what happens in your house can stay in your house. It can be a fulfilling experience. Where is that going? That's the point. Where is our society and culture going? What will the world look like in 5 years, in 10 years? Beyond just the millennials. Unless these days be shortened, there would no flesh be saved alive. And this is really all part of it. You know, initially we might think that marriage is about us, about you. But then it becomes about us. Then it's about us and them. And so it goes by God's design. You know, it's a blessing to be needed. It's a blessing to be needed. And really, it's a blessing to be needy. Mankind has been telling God from the beginning, we don't need you. We can do this ourselves. And of course, that's not the case. Husbands need wives. Wives need husbands. Men need women. Women need men. Children need parents. Parents need children. Whether married or not, people need other people. And above all, we all need God. We all need God. God created us to be needy for a reason. In fact, the body metaphor of 1 Corinthians 12 shows that every one of us is a member of the body and we all perform a function. We all need each member of the body to make it work. Finally, let's turn to 1 Corinthians chapter 13, the love chapter. and just focus on a few verses there. 1 Corinthians 13. Speaking of love, verse 4. Love suffers long and is kind. Is there a limit to your suffering in love? Do you have a threshold that you'll reach and I can't go beyond that? Well, some of us might. But our love will be tested, won't it? It always is. Love suffers long and is kind. Love does not envy. You know, love doesn't covet either. Love does not parade itself. It's not puffed up. It does not behave rudely. It does not seek its own. It's not provoked. It thinks no evil. It does not rejoice in iniquity. It rejoices in truth. It bears all things. It believes all things. It hopes all things. It endures all things. And love never fails. That's the love of God. And that's the kind of love we have the opportunity to develop. That give way, the selfless way. How challenging is that in the midst of our society and culture? Remember the letter to the grandchildren, the future grandchildren. How important are home and hearth, marriage and family, and the lessons we can learn in the context of our relationships with one another on those two commandments hang all the law and the prophets. Important for us to consider. On November 16th, 1959, The Sound of Music, the timeless Rodgers and Hammerstein musical, began a 3.5-year run on Broadway. Several weeks before the show's opening, Oscar Hammerstein was diagnosed with stomach cancer. Prior to being admitted for surgery, the famed lyricist stopped at the theater to convey encouragement and inspiration to his leading lady. He passed a piece of paper to the young actress playing Maria von Trapp. As Mary Martin opened the folded note, here's what she read. A bell is not a bell till you ring it. A song is not a song till you sing it. Love in your heart isn't put there to stay. Love isn't love till you give it away.